are tuned in to the International Connection once again. Today is show number 23 in a series on mind control we're presenting here on CKLN, and today we are interviewing Dr. Stephen Kent, a sociologist from the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Dr. Kent specializes in studying abusive cults and accounts of ritual abuse. Here is that interview. I'm talking to Dr. Stephen Kent, a professor at the Department of Sociology in University of Alberta, Edmonton. Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
And I wonder if you can briefly tell us what your background is and what is the work that you are currently doing.
Okay. I'm a sociologist of religion, and I specialize in the study of controversial religions. These are the groups that are outside the mainstream. These are the groups that are often smaller, but the groups that most people call pejoratively cults. As part of that research, I got involved in studying abuse accounts that people were providing me from their involvement in some controversial religions. By no means is it the case that merely because a group is new or small does it mean that it's involved in any kind of abuse scenarios. But certainly, a lot of abuse does go on in some of these small groups. As part of that process, I was getting really extraordinary accounts about physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Then in October of 1989, I attended a conference on specifically ritual abuse. It was, I believe, a three-day conference. The first day or day and a half was on the kind of alternative groups that I'd been studying. Then the final day and a half was on more groups oriented around the worship of shipping. Something's going on, but I had, at that time, had no direct, been collecting whatever material I could find on satanic allegations in the 17th century, so I had some large conceptual background. It was March, probably February or March 1990, when my first account came. This person was having memories, and she called the university about unusual religious activities, wind up going to my office. So this phone call routed to my office. The person did not identify herself, and I get calls like this from time to time, so I wasn't too surprised about that. But she asked me a question about a symbol. Now, I'm a collector, and I work with a lot of religious materials. I had never heard of this particular symbol, so I asked her a number of normal questions. What was the context of the symbol? Was it on anything? Were people around? And after about the third or fourth question, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, she saw this in a ritual. Got up and closed my office door, and she became the first person to disclose. I spent a lot of time talking to her. Her case eventually led to a police investigation. The pressure of trying to make sense out of her account led me to satanic allegations. That investigation led to the publication of three academic articles on the subject. And even now, 7 years later, I still from time to time get new accounts. There's one person I've been trying to talk to for about 6 years. I now get accounts and queries through the internet, oddly enough, through email. People hear about me and contact me and so on.
Right. When you say ritual abuse, what do you mean by that? What constitutes ritual abuse?
The ritual abuse is any kind of systematic, patterned, disempowering violations. Ritual abuse can take place in a wide variety of contexts. They don't necessarily have to be religious in nature. Moreover, ritual abuse, the systematic, patterned, disempowering violations, can take place in any kind of deviant religious settings. It's simply the case that many of the accounts that have come to me suggest, if the allegations are true, that the people involved in the alleged violations believe that they were engaged in worship of demonic figures, what we would call satanic figures. But I hasten to add that the issue about ritual abuse can go on in mainstream deviant settings. There was a case reported in the Toronto Star a couple of years ago about a healing group in Toronto in the 60s that had collapsed unto itself and got involved in very abusive ritual abuse of children.
And what would be the ritual aspect of that abuse in that case?
Are you familiar with that story, with those accounts?
No, I'm not. But just in a general sense, if it's outside of a religious context, what is the ritual aspect?
In the allegations of ritual abuse that are, say, outside of a religious context, these kinds of abuses could involve a perpetrator who serially violates one person or one child repeatedly. In these cases, the kind of violations would be patterned, and the patterning can be important from the victim standpoint, because each time that the abuse begins, the victim knows what's coming, having been through it several times before. You hear from many victims and alleged victims that they dissociated, that they suddenly rose up to the corner of the ceiling and were gone, or that they created different personalities to take the abuse. Probably they were able to do so because they had been through these ritual patterns many times, and they know in step 3 or 4 what's coming down the road, so they escape the only way they can. These are often children. Even adults who are disempowered can't do the normal kind of reaction, which is to either fight or flee. Consequently, these people, especially children, flee the only way they can, which is psychologically, emotionally. They dissociate.
How prevalent is multiple personality disorder of some sort among the children coming forth with claims of ritual abuse?
Well, keep in mind that I am not clinically trained, so you always want to take what I say about clinical psychological issues with a grain of salt. But my experience suggests that quite a number of people who claim to have been severely, repeatedly sexually abused as children manifest what appears to be multiple personality, dissociative identity, and so on. Some considerable debate exists in the psychological and psychiatric literature about the reality of multiple personality, and it does seem, at least my own non-clinical sense, is that some kinds of treatments by psychiatrists, psychologists, and counselors can make those conditions worse. But I am convinced from the people with whom I've spoken that what's often called multiple personality does exist in and of itself, and that existence can stem from repeated abuse, especially for children. The first person with whom I spoke made allegations about having been ritually abused, but as an adult. It was an important case for me because it seemed very clear that she had dissociated, but she had not formed multiple personalities. My own sense about the dynamics of the formation of multiple personalities suggests that it's most likely to occur amongst people whose personalities are not well formed, that is to say, fairly young children. It's probably easiest for them to shave off and create fantasies, because they're all the elements of their personality, who they are, their relation to family, to friends, their social sense of self, none of those are particularly well developed yet. So again, when adults go through systematic ritual abuse, it doesn't surprise me at all for them to say that they dissociate, forget, have trouble recalling and so on, or have memories come back in floods or rushes that they can't control. But I don't see the adults forming multiple personalities unless the abuse happened at a fairly young age as children. And again, I'm not clinically trained, but that's what my own experience suggests to me.
And in your experience, with a lot of the people that you have come in contact with that have claimed or made allegations of ritual abuse as a child, do you find that a high percentage of these do have some kind of dissociative disorders?
Again, not being clinically trained, I can only give my impressions, but certainly it's, seems very, very clear that many of the people with whom I have spoken talk about different personalities, will describe in some detail the processes of dissociation. They'll give me diaries that have different handwritings. Sometimes they'll be talking to me and they'll go to different voices. I've had one vivid example. I was talking to a person with whom I've been in contact for a long time, called me, and I think she was in some kind of distress. I said, I'll call you right back, made some phone calls, and returned the call in 5 minutes. And this person, who's 30 years old, had what sounded like a 5 or 6 year old answer the phone. It was the same person, but what sounded like her in a different personality. I suggested that instead of staying in her apartment all day, it was a beautiful day, and you go out in the sunlight, there's a big festival going on in Edmonton. I suggested possibly she go out to there to get her mind off these things. And the little tiny voice said that, oh, I can't ride the bus. And I know this person rode the bus all the time, so I said, why not? And the little tiny voice said, because I can't read. So, and there was no indication that this person was making up these issues. In her case, she was one of three daughters, and a second of her sisters also was in treatment for, at the time, was called multiple personality disorder. So two of the three sisters in this family had very bad psychiatric, psychological problems. And you have to ask the question, well, how does something go so wrong in a family? Is it a genetic issue or is it environmental? That is to say, were these, I don't know, is there a bad gene in the family? Or did these two sisters go through fairly horrific systematic abuse that caused these personality fragmentations?
Can you tell us what similarities there are in the accounts of the survivors, especially those that the abuse happened when they were children?
Mm-hmm. There's some research on the similarities of accounts. All of them talk about severe emotional abuse, sexual abuse. Many of the accounts contain allegations about ritual murders. Murders in which sometimes these people claim they were forced to participate in. Many of these accounts talk about these ritual murders in the context of sacrifices. The sacrificial descriptions almost always involve drinking of fluids out of what sounds like a chalice or bowl. It's remarkable how many accounts contain descriptions of what sounds like chalices. Some people who either claim to know or at least are willing to speculate about what the fluids are in the chalices almost always suggest that it's blood or a blood mixture. Sometimes people suggest that urine might be mixed in. Lots of stories about eating flesh, about a victim being killed and then parts of the victim cut up and given to people to eat. Sometimes these people talk about being forced to eat parts of the alleged victims and so on. Many people, almost all the accounts contain people in robes. Sometimes the robes are different colors. High ceremonialism, that is to say, there are some accounts of people being abused at the end of, say, poker games or something, but most of the accounts that I get contain allegations of rituals where there seems to be a leader performing systematic pattern ceremonies involving daggers, often involving chants. And when someone mentions chants, I, without trying to lead them, try to get them to talk about the chants. And many of the people say, well, the chants are not in English. I just couldn't understand them. It's remarkable in those kind of small details to get these general similarities from story to story. Most frequently, parents, if not both, and certainly one seem to be involved in the allegation, sometimes relatives. But that's a very quick overview scenario about the content. Generally, I find that many of these accounts are broadly similar in content, but usually different in details. Mm-hmm. Now, part of what I've tried to do is to collect accounts, wondering whether accounts from independent people ever would match up. That is to say, one way of doing this kind of qualitative research is to get similar accounts from unrelated people. If you get those kind of accounts, then you have a fairly good indication that, something may have happened. It's always important to rule out extraneous external factors in the media, the same therapist, and so on. But when I get similar accounts, or broadly similar accounts with different details, I was actually faced with a real dilemma. I mean, how could one explain these broad similarities but particular differences? And these accounts were coming from, I was getting accounts from people in various countries and people giving accounts of alleged rituals that happened in various countries. Moreover, literature was coming out of Europe, Australia, South Africa, and so on. I was faced with a real dilemma. How could one possibly make sense out of broadly similar accounts from all over the world that were different in details? I spent months trying to figure out, and the answer, when I finally came up with a plausible answer, it was so terribly simple. One explanation is that if these groups existed, then they were all inspired by a similar source. Well, when I tried to figure out what a common source was, I spent months going through very esoteric, arcane, occult books, and the material was so abstract that it just didn't ring true that some of the farmers or school teachers or real estate agents that people were making allegations about military personnel and so on could have understood these texts. The more plausible answer is that people around the world may have been inspired by sections of the Bible. That is to say, if one looks in the Hebrew Bible Old Testament, there are lots of discussions about the god Yahweh in competition with various pagan gods, Baal, Ashtoreth, and so on. Pagan gods, they required human sacrifice, especially child sacrifice. Moreover, in the Christian New Testament, the book records Jesus is talking a fair amount about the power of Satan. Now, Jesus always claims power over Satan, but it's very clear that from some interpretations, Satan is the god of this world. And it struck me like a thunderbolt that if people were deviant, if they were striving for what they considered to be power in this world, and they operated in a religious context, one possible interpretation is that they would go to various portions of the Bible, and whenever God or Yahweh said not to do something, they would construct rituals to do exactly what God said not to do. Moreover, Jesus talks about the power of Satan or use a satanic image to dismiss his opponents. Then deviants would construct rituals around those satanic images. With that focus on the Bible as being a possible source for deviations around the world, for me, the mystery got solved. Then, of course, the issue became more complex. A number of religious books, and religious scriptural books, and quasi-religious books have influence and impact on groups around the world. So we have different Mormon texts, different Masonic texts, and so on. And these books could be the sources of inspiration for deviants inside of those traditions. I mean, it's certainly the case that mainstream Christians, mainstream Freemasons, mainstream Mormons would be appalled at the stories that I've heard. And again, I cannot tell you that these accounts are definitive or true, but nonetheless, normal members of these traditions would be shocked, appalled to hear the kind of things I have. But every tradition has its deviants. Moreover, every tradition probably has sexual deviants. So if people are striving for power in this world and happen to be members of these particular traditions, it's plausible to me that they would take the images in these traditions and twist or distort them. It's also possible, too, that there could be sexual deviants who want to sanctify, to give a religious overview or hue to their deviant sexual activities. Consequently, they could offer up their sexual deviances to what they consider to be a higher power, in this case, Satan or some variations thereof, in order to give their deviations this kind of higher overview sanctification.
How do you know that people haven't picked up these kind of inspiration from the media itself or entertainment, in particular horror shows and shows about Satan and so forth? How did you rule that out from the source of this?
Well, it's difficult to rule it out definitively, but one thing I do simply ask people, now, you cannot always assume that people give accurate answers, but more strikingly, some of the images that people were giving me are not ones that I have seen in any media accounts or outside sources. That is to say, they involved issues that the people themselves could not make sense out of. Some very obscure things. It took me years to find what could be plausible explanations for some kinds of activities. I mean, if you like, I can give one or two examples. One example that comes to mind is a person who talked to me about having a mouse put in her mouth. And I got this account a number of years ago, and at the time I had not a clue what that could have meant. But I was fortunate to get the account on tape. Several years afterwards, McLean's magazine had an article about a federal commission that was going across the country interviewing women about family violence. McLean's article had about two sentences on what it called ritual abuse, and the two sentences said something like, and among the worst accounts that this commission has heard involved a woman in British Columbia, my person was not in British Columbia, who talked about having mice put in her mouth. And it went on with another statement I'll come back to. The other statement was one that the McLean's article linked to the Bible. By that point, I had already figured out that a possible explanation was that the Bible was a source of inspiration. So I went running to my concordance and looked up mouse or mice. There it was in Leviticus, in the food laws, where Yahweh is telling followers which foods are unclean. And one of the unclean foods is mice. So, if you're trying to offer homage to a god in opposition to the Judeo-Christian god, whenever Yahweh says not to do something, you construct a ritual around it. So if Yahweh says don't eat mice, then you put mice in people's mouths in a ritual setting. The other passage in McLean's article referred to this person claiming that she is whitewashed. She had a white, I don't know, paste or paint put on her body. The McLean's article traced that activity to a passage in the New Testament, I believe it's Matthew, where Jesus is railing against his opponents, I think in this case the Pharisees. He says something like, and you opponents are like whited sepulchres or whitewashed tombs in some translations. You know, oh, your opponents are like whitewashed tombs, white on the outside but inside full of death, decay, and rotting bones. Many of my people have talked about having something painted on them, and sometimes they talk about colors, you know, white or white and black. Sometimes they don't know what it is that's smeared on them. If their accounts are true, it could be a paint to indicate that their bodies are like whited sepulchers, you know, whitewashed tombs or gravestones, you might say. Or it could be some hallucinogenic, it could even be bug repellent, although I doubt it. So, excuse me. So it's instances like that where people tell me very obscure facts that they can't make sense out of, that I've never seen, at least at the time in the media, that I've never seen in any kinds of horror shows or whatnot. Issues that make no sense to them, they make no sense to their therapists, make no sense to law enforcement officials, and yet people are convinced that these experiences are ones they've been through. It's these kind of facts that are strongly suggestive to me that they didn't get them from external sources in the media or from therapy suggestion.
This just seems so horrific and outrageous what these people are giving accounts of. And I think a lot of people will find it hard to believe that ritual exists, goes on and exists. How do we know that it's happening, or what attempts have been made by law enforcement or researchers to corroborate this, to prove that it exists or it doesn't exist?
The received social scientific wisdom now is that these accounts almost certainly do not exist. I hold a minority opinion on that issue, or at least let me say that I'm far more open to the possibility that some of these accounts are in fact accurate. When the accounts first started coming forward, they attracted quite a lot of attention in the therapeutic community as well as in the media. It didn't take too long for a backlash against the accounts to come forward, and also I think a growing skepticism on the part of law enforcement. Many law enforcement agencies would undertake investigations and not come up with the kind of definitive proof they would need in order to state clearly that these recovered memories were in fact accurate. Several years ago, some researchers did a large survey. I think they contacted 11,000 people in law enforcement and therapy and so on, who themselves claimed to have received about 12,000 sets of allegations. And according to the study, not one of them had been definitively proven.